Good morning, I am Hans Georg Ruprecht. This is CKCU Literary News, the summer program, bringing you an encore from our programs on contemporary literature, aired in three languages earlier this year. Today we may get a little sidetracked, because this broadcast is about the unconscious. But I think the main focus will be, after all, on literature, thanks to our contributing correspondent, Dr. Robert Richard, a writer, cultural critic, established in Montreal, who's the author of a novel and a fascinating book entitled L'émotion européenne d'Ande, Sade, über Aquin, and whose most recent book is Éblouissement, Gilles Tremblay et la musique contemporaine, to be republished this year. Now, why the unconscious today in 2014? Let me give you a little bit of a context. Freud wrote in his autobiographical essay entitled The History of the Psychoanalytic Movement, published originally in German in 1914, that it is the inevitable fate of psychoanalysis to arouse opposition and to embitter people, end of quote. So why that? It has something to do with what Freud called the theory of repression. In fact, he says, quote, "The theory of repression is the main pillar upon which rests the edifice of psychoanalysis." Freud himself made numerous jokes about the unconscious at a time when he was still trying to fully understand the significance of his clinical findings. One is particularly interesting because it is intertwined with imagery that one could easily find in a work of literature. At the time when he was writing The Interpretation of Dreams, he wrote a letter to his friend Wilhelm Flies, asking him to comment on one of his first chapters. And in this letter, written in the summer of 1898, Freud, while referring to the interpretation of dreams, wrote, quote, "It was all written by the unconscious on the well-known principle of Itzig, the Sunday horseman. Itzig, where are you riding to? Don't ask me, ask the horse." End of quote. So what is the problem with the unconscious? Well, it may be that interplay between the repressed and the return of the repressed, or the relationship between the repressed and the unconscious. Now, how are we coping with our own unconscious? Well, the Scientific American, in its January 2014 issue, provides us with current perspectives based upon cognitive science and neurology. But as you will find out while listening to Dr. Robert Richard, they are as debatable as Freud's views as expressed over 100 years ago. So the debate about the unconscious is far from over. In fact, as Sigmund Freud pointed out in his famous BBC recording made in 1938, so just a year before his death, it was clear to him, and I quote now from the transcript before we cut in this document, People did not believe in my facts and thought my theories unsavory. Resistance was strong and unrelenting. In the end, I succeeded in acquiring pupils and building up an international psychoanalytic association. But the struggle is not over. Now here is Sigmund Freud.
I started my professional activity as a neurologist trying to bring the relief to my neurotic patients. Under the influence of an older friend, and by my own efforts, I discovered some important new facts about the unconscious and psychic life, the role of instinctual urges, and so on. Out of these findings grew a new science, psychoanalysis, a part of psychology, and a new method of treatment of the neurosis. I had to pay heavily for this bit of good luck. People did not believe in my facts and thought my theories unsavory. Resistance was strong and unrelenting. In the end, I succeeded in acquiring pupils and building up an international psychoanalytic association. But the struggle is not yet over. Sigmund Freud.
Our gratitude for making this soundtrack available should be extended to Dr. Epstein, who posted Freud's voice on YouTube. So what are then the current perspectives on the unconscious? While taking issue with some of them, here is now our distinguished contributing correspondent, Dr. Robert Richard.
In a recent issue of the Scientific American, there is an article titled Our Unconscious Mind. The subtitle is Unconscious Impulses and Desires Impel What We Think and Do in Ways Freud Never Dreamed Of. It is written by Dr. John A. Barg, professor of social psychology at Yale University. Professor Barg runs a lab at Yale, a lab with a rather cumbersome name that goes something like this: Automaticity in Cognition, Motivation, and Evaluation Lab. His work consists in investigating unconscious influences on behavior and the extent to which free will really exists. In other words, do unconscious influences impinge on our free will? Are we but the unwitting toys of our unconscious? Maybe our free will is not so free after all, and so forth. The article is well enough written, but I will say right off that I am somewhat appalled by its content. Though Dr. Barg cites Freud and his concept of the unconscious, his use of the word unconscious has nothing to do with Freud's understanding of it. This is not a case of trying to compare apples and oranges. It is more like trying to compare an umbrella with a sewing machine. And since Dr. Barg cannot be suspected of harboring any ambitions as a surrealist, I would just say that he is, well, out in left field. On those grounds, that is, because he uses both Freud's name and his concept of the unconscious in vain, his article is rather idiosyncratic. Dr. Barg comes off as a barker, engaging in a bit of self-advertising, hawking his wares as though at the entrance to a show. So is the name Freud plastered all over the 3 or 4 pages of his article. Does Dr. Barg not feel that his own research has a value in and for itself? Does he feel that he must be seen to cut a giant down to size in order to secure a readership? After all, Freud is the giant that science, American science in particular, loves to hate. So let's try to sort this out. I will first try to see where Dr. Barg's concept of the unconscious comes from, that is, what it thrives on to survive. Then, in a second part, I will try to briefly speak of Freud's own use of das Unbewusste, as the unconscious is called in German. So, let's start with Dr. Barg's definition of the beast he wants to tame, the unconscious. We could see this as just another battle, just another mudslinging match between the two titans known as analytical philosophy on the one side and continental philosophy on the other. Loosely said, Professor Barg belongs to the Anglo-Saxon current of analytical philosophy, where hard-nosed empirical science holds sway. In the realm of analytical epistemology, you, as a scientist, do not sit down with the problem you are dealing with in order to hear what that problem has to say for itself. You just go about solving the problem, often by throwing as much R&D funds at it as possible. Thus, when conducting experiments, let's say in medicine, you always use a cadaver, a dead body, one that no longer speaks, dead bodies that are, by definition, no longer capable of unprogrammed or unpredictable speech. Of course, Dr. Barg's research subjects are alive. They speak, well, at least nominally, for Dr. Barg's research subjects are often party animals. They sit on sofas and unconsciously, quote-unquote, imitate the gestures and poses of their vis-a-vis. But they might as well be dead, since in such party moments they are not truly speaking. Rather, they mostly prattle on and have conversations that would have a Heidegger launch on one of his dire philippics. I am being hard here, and I shouldn't, but heavens, this is, after all, the case for all of us. We are all party animals on a Saturday night, and thus, for the most part, dead to our own rather searing private singularities. And so one suddenly feels like asking, how is it that Dr. Barg never seems to wonder why pretty well all of us come away from a party saying that we hate parties, before barreling off to another party on the next weekend? Why do we all feel a malaise at playing the game of party animal? Where does our discontent come from? And I, of course, use the word discontent as an implied reference to Freud's 1930 book, Civilization and Its Discontents. There is something inside us that makes us more than just party animals. There is a thirst. There is within us an unanswered question, to quote Charles Ives, a disheartenment, a dissatisfaction that would, or at least that should, have us press words and entire symbolic systems into service, as only this might have us finally truly speak, truly say something. But of this possibility, the possibility of real speech, Dr. Barg is totally unaware. For Dr. Barg's world of science limits itself to dead, observable things. The party animals that he queries are like Yorick's uncommunicative skull, and as such, Dr. Barg is a latter-day phrenologist. But I think we need to be more precise if we want to identify or label Dr. Barg's epistemological stance. In this effort, I would say that his position is somewhat, if not very, like Nietzschean. I am referring to the 17th, early 18th century German philosopher Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. He is the philosopher of the little perceptions, of the best of all possible worlds, an idea that Voltaire makes fun of in his short novel Candide, though Voltaire understood but a whit of Leibniz. Leibniz is also the philosopher who spoke of monads, of a pre-established harmony and of the principle of continuity, and who, in his Specimen Dynamicum of 1695, anticipated some of the intuitions that make up quantum physics. So this philosopher is a heavyweight. Let's now look at one experiment on which Dr. Barg dwells. I have already alluded to it. I might as well just quote him. Quote, "In what is known as the chameleon effect, you might find yourself taking on the posture and the physical behaviors of the person that you have just engaged in conversation at a party. The crossed legs, the folded arms, the same head scratching." End of quote. Then Dr. Barg goes on to say this that is extremely interesting. Quote, "These impulses appear throughout the natural world in the way that schools of fish, herds of antelope, and flocks of birds coordinate group behavior so that they move almost as if they were a single organism." End of quote. So, let's try to discover the two Leibnizian elements that are hidden here. The first one has to do with what Leibniz calls the little perceptions. Dr. Barg does not use Leibniz's expression, but in his experiments, he does deal with perceptions that lie just below the level of conscious awareness. As Dr. Barg says, we pick up on these without really realizing it. The slight imperceptible movement of the hand or fingers of the person with whom we are speaking, the fold in that person's clothing, and so on. All little things to which we generally do not pay attention. Now let's go back to Leibniz. To describe what he means by little perceptions, Leibniz uses an analogy. He speaks of the roar of the waves crashing on the beach. The seemingly singular sound of which one is conscious is in fact made up of a vast number of individual sounds of which one is not conscious. That is, droplets of water smacking into one another. According to Leibniz, these little perceptions, occurring just below the surface, shape us. They explain the acquisition of innumerable minor habits and customs which make up a huge part of one's distinctiveness as an individual personality. The second Leibnizian element that can be found in Dr. Barg's work is what is called the principle of continuity, at least a very watered-down version of it. This principle of continuity claims that nature never makes leaps. Natura non facit saltus, says Leibniz in his new essays on human understanding. That is, there is no barren void, no interspersed vacua in nature. This follows from another of Leibniz's principles, the principle of plenitude, which basically means that there are no cracks in nature, no interstices, or no interstitial spaces. I won't go into the details of all of this, especially since in Dr. Barg's article, we are dealing with a Dear Abby version of the Leibnizian principles of continuity and plenitude. Suffice it to say that our Leibnizian Dr. Barg holds that humans do like other humans, birds like other birds, antelopes like other antelopes, and that basically all of nature does like all of the rest of nature. That is, there are no breaks, no real interruptions, no discontinuities in Dr. Barg's world. There is, rather, a kind of preordained harmony underlying everything. Nothing does ever or could ever break through. Nothing erupts. And it is this, the breaks, the eruptions, that is missing in Dr. Barg's world view. So, what about Freud? What is his take on the unconscious? I won't even call it a concept, because the unconscious is not a concept. It is more of an action, a move. It is something that happens, like a slip of the tongue or the forgetting of a name. It is a sort of clinamen, as described by Lucretius, an inaugural moment, if you will. As we just saw, nothing ever really happens in Dr. Barg's system. While here, with Freud, well, head-on collisions are the order of the day. You have, on the one side, the unconscious, with its devil-may-care, carpe diem, vengeful sweep governed by the pleasure principle. And you have, on the other side, consciousness, which tries to have the unconscious walk the straight and narrow of the principle of reality. Thus, the collisions or pitched battle between consciousness and the unconscious. In a later version of his psychological model, Freud has the id colliding with the superego, which leaves the ego stunned, dizzy, and punch drunk. No, not a pretty sight at all. Now, we won't go back to Leibniz here. Rather, let's bring in Charlie Chaplin to understand what is going on. This barroom brawl that I am describing between id and superego is not unlike the famous boxing scene in one of the Charlie Chaplin movies. You may remember the scene. Chaplin is the 90-pound weakling boxing in a ring, throwing uppercuts and so forth, and an opponent. In the melee, the referee tries as well as he can to do his job of having the boxers stick to the rules. It is a very funny scene. In this scene, Chaplin plays the id, trying to get around the rules. The referee plays the superego, trying to get Chaplin to submit to the boxing rules. As for the other fighter, well, he is the odd man out playing the ego. The ego is always the fall guy in this unbridled Freudian fracas between id and superego. This scene has Chaplin's spark of genius. I am pretty sure that Chaplin did not realize that he was filming Freud's second psychological model of ego, superego, and id, complete with boxing gloves and a referee's whistle. And just to go a little further here, I see this Chaplinesque scene as a dynamic recasting of Stendhal's Battle of Waterloo, where everything is covered in a fog and the goalposts are constantly moving. Well, this is the Freudian unconscious, complete with fog and the ever-moving goalposts. In other words, it's no picnic and certainly has nothing to do with a Saturday night party. No, the Freudian unconscious is a bloody Donnybrook. And in such a setting, which is all uproar and rumpus, something is apt to happen. Something is bound to break through. Someone is sure to have kittens here. Be these kittens a symptom or a word, that is speech. Speech as interruption, as discontinuity, as gap. Interesting that Freud's invention of the unconscious comes at the same time as the invention of the typewriter, the which typewriter, said Marshall McLuhan, invented the mistake. Before, when you weren't quite sure about the spelling of a word, you could always fudge it by hiding the mistake somewhere in the spools of your handwriting. The unconscious happens when something goes wrong. Mistake, miscue, misstep, slip, or gap. The unconscious always reveals a failure in identity, a failure in continuity. Like André Breton's attention-grabbing pistol shot in a crowd. The unconscious is not unlike Stendhal's promesse de bonheur, but a bonheur that is here unsettling because something has finally been said. Something has finally broken through. And that something will often take the form of an utterance that is totally beside the point, yet totally dead on. We have a word for such strange utterances. Art. And it is to this that Dr. Barg is blind, deaf, and dumb. His last paragraph is hilarious, and I must quote it here. He says that the results of his research on party animals means that, quote, we can set aside the antiquated notions of the Oedipus complex and accept the reality that the unconscious asserts its presence in every moment in our lives, end of quote. So, in one fell swoop, does our Dr. Barg eliminate all of literature, all of art, music, architecture, and so on. For him, Sophocles and Diderot, Dante and Shakespeare's Hamlet, James Joyce and Hubert Aquin would thus be beside the point, the writers that I cite often giving us a full frontal view of the Oedipus complex. What Dr. Barg just does not seem to know is that it is because speech, real speech, or artistic manifestations are beside the point that they are totally, and I mean totally, dead on. I am Robert Richard in Montreal for CKCU Literary News.
We can also be heard on stream and as podcast at carlton.ca/litnews. All our broadcasts are available on demand at ckcufm.com. Thank you for listening.